Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
What the fuck am I doing? This is crazy. I've never had an all-access pass to anything like this, and I have no idea what is going on, basically.
I'm JP, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and we're one of the oldest independent publications in the United States. We distribute free monthly issues about music, arts, action sports, and subculture. On today's episode, we're going to be learning about Plan B Theater's new world premiere of The Third Crossing. We'll be speaking with Jeffrey Stedman from Yelp. Be learning about Logitech Ultimate Ears and Move to Amend, the political organization that's deeply involved in reversing corporate personhood. The Third Crossing is a play that examines interracial relationships in America. The highlighted example is Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his slave, Sally Hemings, whose children continue to be slaves after birth. The play itself brings together six actors to portray both Jefferson's story and a current look on those relations today. Slug writer Johnny Logan recently sat down with director Jerry Rapier and playwright Deborah Threedy.
Now, Jerry, I know you get to pick the plays that you direct, so what about The Third Crossing made you choose it?
Being half Japanese and half Caucasian and living in a place where half means whole to a lot of people, anything to do with racial identity and racial relations, and even a step beyond that, helping people create a vocabulary about race is really interesting to me. And I find the play to be incredibly insightful as to how to take something historical and apply it to everyday life, which I think is a particular gift that Deborah has as a playwright, to make history accessible. So it's not this dry historical play about Thomas Jefferson. It's using Thomas Jefferson to look at our life now. And I think in this particular political cycle, with a black president and the not-so-thinly-veiled racism that seems to be rampant in our country.
And they're not 100% black president.
Yes. Mixed-race president. So why is he the black president? Why isn't he the white president with dark skin? That combined with just where we are economically and how polarized our country is, I think the play is a great conduit for a conversation about the broader themes. And of course, for me, Deborah alludes to this in the play as well, there's such a similarity between the way she discusses racial inequality and what we're looking at now in our day and age, the last bastion of acceptable prejudice, which is gay marriage. Took me back in our first rehearsal as we're reading through the play, just how strongly those parallels exist. And some people question that. The struggle has been different. It isn't the same struggle, but we should be beyond it being a struggle at all.
Now, Deborah, this is a part of history that a lot of people are familiar with, but we're looking at this at a very different lens than we're usually looking at this part of history, especially dealing with slavery and that sort of thing. Where did the idea for this story come from?
The original inspiration was a novel called Sally Hemings by Barbara Chase Rabode, which is actually referred to in the script in sort of my homage, if you will, to the inspiration for the play. That novel is written by a black woman, and it is written about Sally Hemings, who, in case somebody's been asleep for the last little bit, was a slave of Thomas Jefferson, who it is strongly suspected, and the play takes it as a given, was his mistress for many, many years and bore him a number of children. So Barbara Chase Rabode writes Sally's story from Sally's perspective, which immediately entranced me and caught me and got me thinking. I think one of the things that really caught me was that Sally Hemings and her family, because she was one of a number of siblings, all of whom were in a similar situation, was really a mixed race person at a time in this country where that notion, the whole concept of mixed race, was brand new, and people were just trying to wrap their heads around it. And of course, as I worked on it more and more, the thing that became even more entrancing is that today we're still trying to wrap our heads around the idea of someone who could, you know, be different races. And that led into an exploration of this whole idea of race, which, when you really look at it hard, turns out it's pretty much a fiction. On a biological level, there aren't different races, which is not to say that it's meaningless, because obviously race has tremendous impacts in society, but it's something we've created as opposed to something that's been imposed by either biology or God.
We should explain what the title of the play actually means, because it's kind of jolting. There was a perspective early in the history of this country that the crossing of black bloodlines and white bloodlines three times would
cleanse was the word.
Yeah, cleanse the bloodline and yield a white person, which is horrifying for me to even say, but the way that applies to the Sally Hemings, Thomas Jefferson relationship is that their children were the third crossing. And some of her children were passable as white people.
Most of her children passed as
like white skin with red hair, but they were still slaves in his home. That just, it's so difficult, I think, for us to wrap our minds around slavery, period. But slavery that isn't so obviously drawn based on skin color is even one step crazier.
And it's also, it's why the rule that three crossings would clear the blood ends up getting replaced within 100 years, not even that long from when Thomas Jefferson is talking about this rule of law. And it was a rule of law. And it gets replaced by the legal rule of one drop. In other words, one drop of black blood was so potent that it totally wiped out any white blood and made you black, which of course then led to a whole nother set of issues about racial identification and how do you prove it. It's just, it's fascinating to look at. There's one scene in the play where a light-skinned woman and a black man have been married, and now they're being prosecuted for the crime of violating the Racial Purity Act, which prohibited interracial relationships. And the woman says, but I'm not white. I'm black. My mother's black. My father was black, you know. And the judge and the jury say, we don't believe you. You look white. Therefore, you are white. Therefore, you and your husband have committed this crime. And I've often wondered what happened to that poor lady, because it meant she couldn't marry black men because she was quote unquote white. But yet the one drop rule meant that she was black, so she could also get in trouble for marrying a white man. Who was she supposed to marry?
You know? The one drop rule is kind of really gender biased, because like with women it was usually, you know, that they were white if they looked white, and with men if they looked white, if there was a single drop, then they were black.
Yeah, that gets into a whole other gender mess there.
Not to mention, and this is one of the themes of the play, is that over the hundreds of years, all the time of slavery and post-slavery, there are a lot of people who have, it's called crossed the color line. In other words, born in one race and decide, you know, for whatever reason, that they're going to live in a different race. Which means that none of us can actually be 100% positive that we're not subject to that one drop rule.
And I think what's key for people to understand, I think that we have such a short memory as Americans that we don't realize that it was illegal for anyone non-white to marry anyone white until 1968 in this country.
That's pretty amazing.
Even just last year, there were at least a half a dozen cases where people who worked for the state would be refusing to marry mixed race couples. So yep.
It's not a problem that is going away anytime soon. But the bigger picture, we just don't seem to learn from our mistakes as Americans. And, you know, following 9/11, people of Middle Eastern descent, their life has been hell for the last decade. It's so amazing to me how not careful people are with what they say.
Thank you.
I think part of the problem, especially here in America, is we hear a lot about the amazing things that America's done, you know, in school and especially growing up, and we don't hear a lot about the negative things that have gone on in America. I think that's a lot of part of the problem why this sort of thing keeps repeating itself.
Well, slavery, the Trail of Tears,
yeah.
Japanese internment, the reaction, racial profiling following 9/11. We have no room to talk to China about their human rights violations. I mean, who are we? It's so hypocritical. Like, we need to take care of the problems in our own country. And these aren't simple things, which I think the play illustrates too. They don't go away because people are uncomfortable with them. They compound themselves. And I remember, you know, hearing aunts and uncles and my parents growing up talk about slavery and the impact on African-American people in our country now, and not understanding that something that existed for hundreds of years can't be undone in a generation. The impact of that is so much greater than somebody signing a document one day emancipating people of one race. The fact that a race could be emancipated is the problem.
One of the things I've learned from my study of law and privilege and power is that even with the best will in the world, it is very difficult for people in a position of privilege to give up that privilege. In a gender context, there can be, and I have known many in my life, men of goodwill who think of themselves as not discriminating against women, but who get very defensive if you kind of point out that there is something in the organization, and I'll use academia, that is kind of stacked in
favor
of men.
They get even more defensive
men.
If a man brings it up.
You know, the same holds true for racial privilege. With the best will in the world, it's still very difficult for whites to give up the privilege that whiteness has given them, which they don't even have to think about. But to me, one of the most powerful stories I heard, a woman, a black professor, was speaking, and she talked about how if you're white, you walk into a store, and the attitude of the salespeople in the store is that you are their customer, you're there to buy, and they want to help you. You're a black woman, and you walk into a store, that's not the assumption you're greeted with. You know, you have to sort of establish by all sorts of markers, the way you're dressed, the way you carry yourself, you are someone who is legitimately there to buy things, not steal them. And that, for me, was kind of a real eye-opener about the sort of invisible privileges that whiteness gives you.
It's fascinating. Carlton Bluford, who's one of the actors in the play, he and I have talked a lot about his experience growing up black in Ogden, and trying to figure out what it means to be, how do you navigate that when you are so clearly different from everyone around you? And that was my experience growing up too. I didn't talk about crossing the color line. I tried so hard not to be different when I was younger, because I grew up in a town where I grew up very close to Mexico, so a lot of people of Mexican descent, a lot of white people, and there was me and one girl from Korea in our town, and we looked so much different than everybody else, and so we tried very hard not to stick out. And it wasn't until I was an adult that I realized what a disservice I had done to myself, that I hadn't learned about my own heritage because I didn't want anyone to notice it. But it's kind of not negotiable to be noticeable, you know? But so I embraced my ethnic heritage late in life. And I think that's what a lot of people in the last few generations have had to come to terms with. How do you embrace it, but how do you assimilate, and why is, or how do you do both, or should you do both, or should you do either? And a little bit tricky in a city like this particularly.
The world premiere of The Third Crossing is Thursday, March 8th at 8 p.m., and the work runs until March 18th. For more information on the play, visit planbtheater.org, and for tickets and available dates, visit arttix.org. Mara Loca is a metal band with members from Salt Lake City and Provo. The group is made up of former and current members of Parallax and God's Revolver. Mara Loca joined Denver-based hardcore band Cannons for a split 12-inch release in December of last year. and the band recently celebrated a belated album release party for the LP on March 2nd with Cornered by Zombies and Eagle Twin. From that self-titled split 12-inch with Cannons, here's Thetchney. This is Mara Loco with Thetchney from a self-titled split 12-inch with Cannons. To download the full 12-inch or purchase the physical copy, you can visit maraloca.bandcamp.com. Every once in a while, we like to have community manager of Yelp come into our studios and talk to us about what's going on in the Yelping community. Yelp is an app and a website that lets users review restaurants and businesses of all sorts. We're joined today by that aforementioned manager. I like to call him the Yelp Wrangler, Jeffrey Stedman. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited to be here today again. Thank you.
We are going to talk about one of my favorite subjects again. Food.
Yeah, absolutely. Today we're talking about dim sum, and I thought we'd turn to all things knowledge to figure out exactly what dim sum is. If some of your some of our listeners here aren't familiar with it, basically it's just a style of Chinese food, which is small, bite-sized food that comes out, you know, usually in steamer baskets in a restaurant. Usually you get it on the weekends at some of our local Chinese restaurants, and it's steamed stuff and it's whatever in a cart, and it just keeps coming by, and you grab what looks good or what you like or try some different things, and it's you know, you go with a big group of friends and just keep pulling stuff off the cart and eating dim sum. So, I mean, you really just have to do it to see what it is.
Sometimes dumplings, sometimes like chicken feet prepared in different ways, from the exotic to the normal, like pot stickers, everything in between.
Yeah. It's typically the dumplings, I think, are the most popular, but there's ready buns with pork inside or the kind of meat, just all kinds of stuff. But yeah, all the way down to chicken feet, which are actually, I've had them pretty good.
Where did you have that at?
There's a place in West, I think it's officially West Valley, maybe it's still Salt Lake, 3361 South Redwood Road, a place called Red Maple Chinese Cuisine. It's a pretty big place. If you're curious, it's 3.5 out of 5 stars after 29 reviews on Yelp. Hang W, who's a pal of mine, said, "Finally, a place that brings me a little closer to the true dim sum houses of Hong Kong. I appreciate the white shirts and bow tie uniforms." I think they probably have the best service of our local Chinese and dim sum places. It's a big restaurant, and I guess maybe a good place to start if you're curious about what dim sum is or how it works, go to the reviews on Yelp for Red Maple Chinese Cuisine and read Eve L's review, because she kind of goes like ABC how it all works and when to go and what the best stuff is. So
that's what I love about Yelp. I've been using it a lot more lately now that we've been talking, and some of the reviewers just nail it. They give you history, they give you the pros and cons of the place, and apparently, in the case of the reviewer you just mentioned, like really good step-by-step of everything that's going on.
For sure, yeah. Yelp really is all about the quality of the content. We really just want to like take all these people, because, you know, there's so many people in so many different neighborhoods who really love these restaurants, who love these boutiques, who love all these different places, and they want to go into detail. They really want to tell the world about what they love. So yeah, that's I'm glad you're using. That's definitely what we're there for.
And what are some of the other places around town the Yelpers are talking about that are great for dim sum?
I'd say if you're going to start, probably the best place to start would be Hong Kong Tea House, which is 565 West 2nd South. It's 3.5 out of 5 stars after 29 reviews. And it's right over there by in the venue. It's kind of a more standard fare, great for beginners, a pretty decent ambiance in there. Jacqueline M., for example, she goes in, she says, "We mostly go for dim sum. Our favorites are sticky rice and lotus leaves." She always orders a bunch in addition to go. Barbecue pork buns, beef wiyanoki mushroom roll, which she says has an amazing sauce that goes well on just about everything, smothering it all over her rice, crab claws, barbecue pork. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of stuff there, and it's a pretty wide appeal. So Hong Kong Tea House. I think you've been there, haven't you?
Yeah, that's the first place that I ever tried dim sum at, so coincidentally enough.
Great for beginners.
People should start there.
Yeah.
Where else from there? Where do people go next?
If you really get into it, you kind of dig in the stuff and want maybe a little bit more variety, maybe you want to kind of head a little down the road a little bit to some of this, I guess, harder to find stuff, go to Cafe An Hong. Cafe An Hong is 4 out of 5 stars after 38 reviews, 1465 South State Street. Ken C. says, "The server told us it's busier in the mornings when they bring out a wider selection of off-menu items." So that's probably going to be your best bet, is to head there in the morning. That's kind of a general rule of dim sum. Like, the later you go in the day on the weekends, the less selection you're going to have, because they really just have a lot of stuff going there for like early lunch. And then Golden Dragon, which has moved, is at 1716 South State Street now. They're 3.5 out of 5 after 32 reviews on Yelp. Yiching P says, "They serve authentic dim sum with the more well-known shrimp dumplings, shumai, turnip cakes to roasted pork with thick and crispy skin, taro dumplings and chicken feet, and even blood cakes." So again, you're gonna take a little more adventure. I think you've been to Golden Dragon, or to the old Golden Dragon.
Yeah, one of the two.
Yeah,
I had some really good shrimp there. So one of the Golden Dragons I can vouch for.
Okay,
new and or old.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. So give it a go. It's a little better than its old location. A little cleaner. Some legit stuff. And again, you know, some of that stuff that maybe you won't find in some of the more basic dim sum places. And then I think the last thing, if you don't want to go out, if you want to try it kind of on your own, Ocean Mart is one of these great Asian markets that has frozen dim sum. Ocean Mart is at 115 West 90th South, so it's out in Sandy right next to the DABC. 4.5 out of 5 stars after 18 reviews. Sabrina C. says, the frozen dim sum are always fun. Buy an assortment, steam, and dip in the sauce of your choice. And she also says, hey, don't have a steamer? You can buy a traditional or electric one while you're there.
I've heard of that place. It's one of the best Asian marts in town.
Yeah, from what yeah, I yeah. Hear. Yeah, it's pretty big, and it's right there off the freeway on 90th South, so you can hop off and get dim sum or, man, any of those things that you need, that you're craving.
Well, thank you, Yelpers, for reporting on all the great dim sum in town. Thanks for doing the research on that, Jeffrey. Now, can we talk about something else that's still kind of related to food?
Yes, indeed.
Actually, it's my favorite kind of food. March 14th is coming up. Why don't you explain to the layperson what that means to the foodie?
Yeah, March 14th is Pi Day, right? 3.14, which is pie. We've talked about pie here on the podcast before, and Yelpers love pie, and we're celebrating pie. So I'm pretty excited to tell everybody who's listening about Yelp's Pi Day Partay, which is how we're spelling it. We're going with Partay because it really is a big party, and I wanted to invite everybody who's listening to come out to Yelp's Pi Day Party. Let me give you the lowdown. 3.14 Pi Day, which is March 14th. We are going to celebrate all the great pizza pie and dessert pie, some of the favorite places in Salt Lake City. So we're going to be gathering at Pierpont Place, which is a gorgeous venue just a few blocks from here, 163 West Pierpont. And we're inviting some of these great restaurants to come and sample their pie, their pizza pie, and their dessert pie. And it's going to be a big free party. Everybody is invited to come, but you do have to RSVP. And you do that by going to yelp.com/events. You have to have a Yelp account, but that's free and pretty easy to set up. And it's just a big night dedicated to celebrating great pie here in Salt Lake City.
I didn't know you guys were doing pizza. That's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, it's, there's just so many different kinds, from the flatbread to the deep dish to the authentic Italian to the stuff thrown together by swarthy dudes. I mean, there's room in this universe for all kinds of pie, JP. And we're just trying to let people get out and taste some of these different places around town who are making great pies and, of course, dessert pies. And there's no better time to do it than 3.14. So, yeah, put on your calendar. Come on out. It goes from 7 to 9 p.m. and it's free. There will be a cash bar there as well.
I just want to point out the best place in the universe for pie is in my stomach. I don't know if people knew that. Little known fact. Can you give us a sneak peek on what businesses might be there? Who's coming to purvey their wares?
We're going to have folks like our good friends over at Pie Hole for pizza.
Oh, great.
Pie Hole is, again, about like 380 or so South mm-hmm. State Street.
And shout out to the Bird Dog.
Exactly. Shout out to the Bird Dog. They have some great pizza there. And as far as dessert pie, our good friends at Penny Ann's Cafe will be one of the folks who will be there serving up some of their fantastic pie. Again, if you haven't been...
Yeah, they should try it out, because I took your recommendation after our pie episode. Their peanut butter pie is... it makes me smile inside.
Yeah, they have a new one. I don't know if you tried this. They have a new one. It's the cookies and cream pie.
I will put that in me.
And it's magical.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Like an Oreo style cookie?
Completely. It's basically, it's like eating a pie made out of Oreos, except a little less lardy.
I can sign off on that.
It goes down smooth. It's really good. So they're going to be there serving up some samples, Pie Hole, and a bunch of other people. Go to yelp.com/events. Check it out. RSVP, and we'll see you out there for the big free Pi Day Partay.
Another great benefit of having you here is the invites to all your awesome Yelp events. Thanks again, Jeffrey, for stopping by and giving us the lowdown.
Yeah, absolutely. Get together, get with some friends, go out and try some dim sum, and you'll definitely find something you like.
I'll see you on March 14th.
Let's do it.
Ultimate Ears was founded in 1995 by Van Halen's touring manager, Jerry Harvey, after he noticed the band's drummer was having issues hearing the music. The company then partnered with West One, and then later with IEM for several years, until being acquired by Logitech back in 2008. They make high-end custom earbud designs for musicians, as well as custom fit designs for your average consumer. Our podcast producer and Slug's office coordinator, Gavin Sheehan, recently spoke with Logitech engineer Philippe de Palenz about the headphones and their design. Do you feel my pulse against your wall?
Logitech mainly works with computer accessories. What made you decide to get into audio works?
As a matter of fact, Logitech has been in the audio business for about 20 years through our acquisition that was called LabTech. So we've been making speakers and headphones and headsets for a long, long time. Also through an acquisition that we made in about 5-6 years ago called Squeezebox Radio, we also got into the business of internet radio and therefore playing music when we made that acquisition. So we've been there for a long time.
Aside from the computer accessories, like going from like just the speakers that you have to the earbuds now,
yep.
like how did that decision come about?
The earphones and headphones are a natural extension of the speaker business, if you will, because people experience music either through speakers or if they want a personal experience, they want to use earphones and headphones. So in about 2007, 2008, we wanted to expand in that business, but we wanted to do it with a good story, a real story, something authentic, not just going to China and buying a bunch of parts from different manufacturers and put them on the shelf with a logo. And we discovered Ultimate Ears with this beautiful background in making devices for musicians and having this really good and great market share in that business, and also those great relationships with musicians. And most products, and actually all products from Ultimate Ears, were designed in collaboration with Ultimate Ears. So that's why we decided to buy this company, and that's how we entered that business with a story, with something that was substantial.
Why specifically go with the custom earbuds rather than the one-size-fit-all people have become used to with companies like Apple and Sony?
We started with the custom, and the custom has this unique ability to, A, play music beautifully because we isolate you from the outside of the world. Second, you no longer have all these issues of fit and comfort because this device bracing the shape of your ear. Now, not everybody can afford a custom. Custom is sort of the high end of the earphone. So we decided to create a series of products that would be taking some of the similar technology that we're using in custom, but then we're using what we call universal tips, or those little foam tips or silicone tips that we put at the end of our devices. So we actually offer both.
Why specifically earbuds and not branch out in professional canned headphones that are now going around?
So our heritage was a heritage of custom ear monitors. So everything was inside the ear. But we are definitely looking at other ways of playing music, and headphones is definitely a business that we could expand in.
Tell us a little bit about the technology behind Ultimate Ears and what makes them different from other earbuds.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one, which is a very important one, is this ability that we have of taking what we call an ear impression, which is essentially putting some silicone in your ear and getting the exact mold of your ear and then transforming that into an earphone that's going to fit you perfectly. So there's an art and a science to that. So that would be one of the first technology that we have. The second one is something that we call armatures. Armatures are essentially very, very small speakers that were initially designed for the hearing industry, but that we tune for the music. And the beauty of armatures, those little tiny speakers, is you can put several of those speakers together inside the same earphone, and you can design an earphone of very high-end quality because you can dedicate each of those armatures or those little speakers to a specific range and frequency of the music, right? So you can create an armature that is dedicated to the lows, you can have one dedicated for the mid, and one dedicated for the highs. And our background, our art, is our ability to put those speakers together and stack them up in a way where the music is played just like it was recorded.
Other than the price, what would you say some of the differences are between the customs and the more affordably priced ones that are adjustable?
So the most important piece is the fact it is a custom fit, and it is your product that fits in your ear, right? So the major advantage that you have is you're going to be able to wear it for a long time, and it's going to fit inside your ear and never fall out, as opposed to many of the other ones that have little ear tips, because it goes so deep inside your ear. And that was something that we developed over many years, working with musicians on stage, jumping and dancing, you know, having a good time, singing, whatever they are doing. And their earphones cannot fall out, because that's a device that allows them to hear themselves.
You have a wide variety of options, from precision audio for engineers to simplistic audio for the casual listener. What made you decide to offer so many options rather than focus on just a couple of areas?
If you're talking about the range of custom inner monitors that we have, there are actually two different things that we do. The first one is, as you go up in price points, we improve the quality of the audio by adding more speakers and tuning the speakers in a way where you have more range, more quality. Second thing that we do is we tune each of the armatures for a different sound signature. So for instance, I can give you a couple examples. We have the UE7, which is that has a sound signature that is relatively perceivably flat. It has a very high ability to go very loud. And a lot of these products are actually bought by a guitar player, right? It just sounds really good for a guitar player. You go to our UE11, there we spend a lot more time focusing on the lows and providing really great level of details in the lows, and very often drummers buy that product. Another product that we did is a collaboration that we did with Capsule Studio. And here what we did is we designed this product to guarantee a perceived flat response. This allows a studio engineer or a mixing engineer, a mic engineer, to actually take this product on the road and have it as a reference. And regardless of the environment that they are in, they will always be able to hear the sound as it was anywhere else they've been before, because the room does not have an impact on the quality of the sound, because the device is inside your ear and the room is your ear. You can see we design products for different target applications, different environment where they can be used. And so that's the differentiation that we have. It's not just a standard good, better, best for custom.
What professional singers and musicians have purchased a pair, and what's their reaction been to the product?
It's one of those reactions like, why did I wait so long to buy a pair? As soon as they put the product inside their ear, they are just amazed by the quality of what they are hearing. And very often the feedback that we receive is like, you know, initially it made me feel a little bit bad, because all of a sudden I realized that as I was singing, that I was missing a few notes here and there. And so the majority of the time what we hear is, as soon as they buy those devices, they perform better. It allows them to perform better because they are so immersed into their arts. And because we have a very strong isolation from the noise of the stage, it allows them to be completely immersed into that experience.
Do you plan on expanding into audio any more than you already have as a company?
Yes, of course. We constantly want to be a leader in this environment, and we're working on a couple of very, very cool technologies that I would love to share with you as soon as they come out. But yes, we are definitely in the process of looking at new ways of, you know, innovating and continuing to create some really cool product for musicians and music lovers.
For more information on the headphones, visit logitech.com/UE. And to read our review of the Ultimate Ears custom fitted headphones, check out our February 2012 issue in the product review section or on slugmag.com. It's time once more for the weekly daily calendar rundown. I am joined by Gavin, our infamous producer. Thank you, Gavin, for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I guess us, the royal we, or the listening audience, let's say that.
Sure.
When I refer to myself as the royal we, people don't like it. As much as I respect it, they don't. Thank you for joining us. A willing and able and, you know, I'd say almost an improvement on Astaire.
I wouldn't say willing. I definitely wouldn't say improvement.
Oh, you're right. I didn't either. I was trying to make you feel better, man.
She's going
to
kick your ass next week.
Jeanette's not going to like this side talk. It's kind of...
Oh, well.
Let's get right into the events. Tuesday, March 6th, another edition of Hot Buttered Rum with Cornmeal at the Stateroom. Tasty, right?
I'm hungry. I have no idea what those two things are, but I'm hungry for it now.
Those are bands, Gavin.
I'm hungry for those bands.
That's all you need to say about that. And Thursday, March 8th, the Growlers, A La La's, and Spell Talk at Urban. I've seen the Growlers perform and Spell Talk as well. I don't know about these A La La's business.
I haven't seen A La La's yet. I've heard good things. Growlers are awesome. And, of course, Salt Lake City's own Spell Talk.
Former City Weekly Music Award winners, all-around great guys as well. And the Growlers, I concur, really, really good show. And also on that day, happy birthday, of course, to our metal coordinator, Napalm Flesh writer extraordinaire, Briar Wharton.
What up, Briar?
He's a really great guy.
I know. He comes in and he'll talk your ear off about metal. all kinds of metal.
Which is what everyone wants to do.
Obviously. Him and Gavin Hoffman.
Friday, March 9th, we've got something called a Localized.
Yeah, it's our monthly concert series that we have over at the their Urban Lounge. And this month we're going to have kind of a little mixture of art rock and instrumental and video game type music with OK Akumi, the popular band The Moth and the Flame out of Provo, and Wake Up Nebula.
We're actually going to get a lot of Provoites into Urban Lounge, which is my favorite type of crowd to get in there. And Friday, March 9th through 11th, one of my favorite events is going on downtown at the Salt Palace Convention Center.
Oh, the Salt Lake Tattoo Convention.
That's what I'm talking about.
It takes over 3 days of that Salt Palace.
It's a huge convention hall full of everything your conservative mother or grandmother warned you about.
You need to find the traditional tattoos where they spend 8 hours with planks of wood just beating the shit into you.
And Saturday, March 10th, Slug Games Shred the Park After Dark at Park City Mountain Resort.
Yeah, look at us. Second return. We always do this over at Park City Mountain Resort. They're really cool people.
Literally after dark.
It is. We're going to have an evening's competition.
Also, I want to mention something before I let you go, Gavin. We've got an iPhone app that people can access our daily calendar events on and also our issues. And they can call our podcast now via the iPhone app. Did you know that?
You don't say. I knew that.
Yeah, you did know that.
I helped, kind of.
You helped invent that.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
I came up with the idea, and then someone smarter, Kate O'Connor, made it happen.
In other news, water is wet, Gavin. Thank you for joining me today.
Wow. And if anybody wants to call just regularly on their phone, if they are like you and they don't have an iPhone, 858-233-9324 is our voicemail line. Call in. You may actually hear yourself on this show. I'm the one that listens to all those calls.
Yeah, we've been getting a lot of really great calls lately.
You are nasty, nasty people.
Yeah, thank you for all of them. Some we can't play, but if you have any suggestions for shows, comments, or anything that we could actually play that doesn't involve too many F-words and references to our mothers, we will play it on air.
Only 3 references to your mothers per phone call.
Preferably my mother. She's a saint, so keep it classy.
Is she now? That's not what she said last night. You set yourself up for that, Trebek. Thanks for having me, JP.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gavin.
The Moth and the Flame is an art rock group based out of Provo, Utah. It was originally comprised of Brandon Robbins on guitar and Mark Gerbe on keyboard, but the duo recently recruited Andrew Tolman on drums and Nate Pfeiffer for audio programming. The band released their self-titled full-length album in November of 2011, with a release show so successful that the group had to schedule a second one to accommodate people. Here's their song Dreaming from their self-titled album. That was The Moth and the Flame with Dreaming from their self-titled debut album. You can catch The Moth and the Flame this Friday for Slug Localized at the Urban Lounge. They'll also be playing with Wake Up Nebula and OK Akumi. The door price, as usual, is just $5, and the show starts at 10 p.m. To read more about the group, you can check out our interview with them in this month's issue. And to buy the album, see their music videos, and join up on their mailing list, visit their website at howwewokeup.com. In 2011, the Supreme Court reversed a lower court decision on the case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission. The decision holds that the First Amendment prohibits government from placing limits on independent spending for political purposes by corporations and unions. Move to Amend is a national movement to have an amendment added to the Constitution declaring once and for all that democracy is about people over profit, amending that decision. Today I'm joined by Ash Sanders. She's from Move to Amend, the organization that is trying to accomplish that very goal that we just mentioned. Thank you for joining us, Ash.
Thanks for having me.
As mentioned on movetoamend.org, they've gone after our tax dollars, our public services, our jobs, our schools, our military, our votes, our future, our freedoms, and the federal courts have helped them every step of the way. And they, of course, being corporations. Will you speak to what this means to you?
Yeah, well, it's quite a list, and I think all of those things are true. I came into organizing against corporate rule because everything that I did, whether it was environmental justice or labor organizing or whatever it was, all came to the same conclusion, which is that corporations were so powerful that none of the organizing we did was going to be successful without addressing their power. And so corporations have a long and sordid history of doing anything for profit. And as part of that, as they've run out of options, they've started taking over the public realm. It was bad enough when they were messing up the private realm, but now they're going after the public realm and trying to privatize that so that they can make even more profit off of destroying what communities and individuals want for themselves.
And what is Move to Amend doing to counter these machinations the federal courts have utilized or enacted recently to help corporations?
So it's interesting because the corporations have gotten most of what they call their constitutional rights. Those are quotation marks around rights for those of you listening. They've gotten most of those by going through the Supreme Court, which is the least democratic and probably most boring branch of our government. And so Move to Amend is responding by trying to go with the most grassroots and interesting branch of our government, which is the people. And so we're organizing people across the country, city by city by city, to come together and pass escalating resolutions calling for an amendment to the United States Constitution that says money isn't speech and corporations aren't people and shouldn't have the rights of people. And we're doing that by organizing, like we said, on a local level, and then moving to the county, and then moving to the state, and finally having the states call on Congress through a massive grassroots movement to pass this amendment, and then to move on towards the ultimate goal, which is little d democracy. In other words, empowering people to make decisions for their communities that they should make rather than corporations making them for them.
And people use the term corporate personhood. So if somebody's heard about that before, that's what we're talking about, that corporations actually have unlimited abilities to influence government, basically through lobbying and through super PACs and things like that. How did you get involved with community activism, and can you give us a little bit of a rundown? I know that you worked getting Ralph Nader to counter Dick Cheney's BYU commencement address back in 2007, and you kind of joined up with Ralph Nader. Can you talk about how that happened and what you've done since then?
Yeah, so I went to BYU, boo hiss, right? And while I was there, I was living my life, and they announced that Dick Cheney would be our commencement speaker, and I and a lot of other people were not too happy about that, and so we organized a big alternative commencement. We had over 1,000 people come to another kind of commencement where we took all the problems of the Cheney administration and then found speakers to speak to those problems and say what they would do to solve those problems instead of what Dick Cheney had done. And so from there, I kind of went off on that path, and I worked for Ralph Nader, etc. And that led me pretty unbendingly into the path of fighting against corporate power, which is what I've been doing ever since in different aspects of the movement, most lately with the climate movement, but overall fighting for communities against corporate rule.
And you actually were part of the Occupy DC movement. You helped to organize that. And will you talk a little bit about that process of the Occupy DC?
Yeah, so I helped organize the occupation of DC and Freedom Plaza. And we actually were a parallel effort. Occupy Wall Street was organizing in parallel to our work, but they started first and it took off. And so we just became another Occupy satellite, basically. But it's similar ideas to the Move to Amend ideas. You know, the reason I'm working for both of those groups is because corporations have taken over our country, we can't make meaningful decisions, our system is broken, and people are trying to find all sorts of ways to rise up and actually do something radical that will alter the power structure and redistribute it back to the people so that people have decision-making power. And that's what Occupy is all about, as a kind of direct action bubbling up phenomenon, and it's also what Move to Amend is about in terms of an organized political institutional resistance to that kind of power structure.
I've been thinking a lot lately about what led to this circumstances that passed that corporate personhood Supreme Court decision, and I wanted to know your take on how culpable your average American citizen is in this process. Do you think that generalized apathy has a part to play in this, or where do you think we as a people fit into the fact that they're getting away with what highway robbery is, as it were?
Right. Well, I think there's two answers, and the first is kind of your standard historian's answer, which we've got a lot of bread and circus going on, right? Like, people are eking by, some of us, a lot of us aren't, a lot of us are eking by enough to say, okay, whatever. And then we're being entertained by the spectacle of what have you, fill in the blank, American Idol, etc. And so a lot of us are really, really apathetic. But I also think apathy is a result of people understanding the power system and saying, hey, I'm not going to go and vote for the evil in the blue suit versus the evil in the black suit. I don't think that's a real choice. And so a lot of people know the score and they know they're not powerful. And I think that cynicism is the wrong answer. I think organizing is the answer. And so we have to organize to make the system actually a system that represents us and then is by us and for us, rather than a system that robs us of any meaningful decisions whatsoever.
Some people, you're speaking about the system, some people think that it's too corrupt, that change through regular channels like Move to Amend that is trying to utilize is impossible. What would you say to these people?
I would say that they're almost entirely right, but not entirely right. So I would say that they're right in their analysis of Washington being one of the most corrupt places you could possibly be in at this moment in the world, and they're right about the fact that our politicians don't care about our will, and they can't, even if they were the best people on earth. They're getting corporate money, they're doing corporations' bidding, right? But I also think that we should think about all these successful movements in the past that sought to radically alter the power structure in the United States, materially benefit poor people or disenfranchised people, and all of them were going into blank occupied territory, right? So abolitionists were going into slaveholder-occupied territory. women suffragists were going into patriarchy-occupied territory. All these people were basically taking it to the centers of power, and through mass mobilization and organization, they actually got what they wanted, or at least part of what they wanted. We're all still working on those problems, right? But we believe in the same kind of thing, that we can organize on the grassroots in a way that is demanding, not groveling or asking, and in a way that directly attacks systems of power that seek to have power over people, and say something that a lot of people can agree with, which is, don't you think that communities should decide what happens to them and what happens in their neighborhoods, what happens to their sky, to their rivers, etc.? And that's an issue that a lot of people can agree on, and so that's what we're trying to mobilize around.
And quite effectively, it seems like. The website is a really good resource, movetoamend.org. And can you tell us a little bit about how people can utilize that website and get more involved in the movement and get more information?
Yeah, so Move to Amend is a national coalition of organizers and communities that are working on this. So they're kind of an umbrella organization, and their website, movetoamend.org, can tell you all sorts of things about the history of corporate rule. And that's important because a lot of people know about Citizens United, which is great, but I don't know if y'all were around in, 2009 before it passed. Life wasn't that good then either, and that's because Citizens United is just the latest part of a long coup that corporations have waged against people in the United States and a lot of rights that they've taken over. So the website can tell you about that long history and also about the first 75 years of our country when regular people had actually a huge amount of power over corporations and there were very, very strict laws against them doing lots of things that they do freely and nefariously now. And so it tells you about that. And it can also tell you how to get involved in Salt Lake's movement, where we're organizing on a local level to prop up what the campaign is seeking to do ultimately on a federal level.
Is movetoamend.org taking donations right now? How can people monetarily help them out?
They are, yeah. You can go to their website and you can sign the petition that says you want an amendment to the United States Constitution, and they are very shoestring, super grassroots. The people who organize this are organizers. They have an organizer mentality. They're not some top-down glossy NGO, and so they could definitely use your money. So you can go and donate to them, and you can also, the best way to help out an organizer, right, is by bringing your body and brain to where they are and helping out by actually hitting the streets. So they can also come to Salt Lake's meetings. We meet every Wednesday from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Peaceful Uprising Warehouse, which is 1361 South Main Street. We're meeting this Wednesday. Anyone who's listening can get involved in any one of our working groups and help us canvass so we can get a resolution on the November ballot.
Well, what are your final thoughts on the future of America and the role that corporations play in politics and daily life?
That's a very good last big question. I think that if we don't stop corporations, not just, make them more socially responsible, but if we don't stop them from ruling over us, we're just going to see more of the same until some kind of collapse of capitalism, because capitalism is not sustainable. I don't know if you've heard that, It can't keep going. It has
at least
a
the Americanized
limit.
Version of capitalism.
The Americanized version of capitalism, and certainly corporate capitalism. And the fall of capitalism is going to hurt a lot of people. And forget that, even if it doesn't happen, the rise of capitalism has hurt a lot of people. And so the goal is to bring back people power to where it belongs, which is in our communities, to make real decisions instead of small ones. And to remember that revolutionaries, for example, American revolutionaries weren't asking for like a more socially responsible king. They were asking for the end of monarchy, and we're doing the same thing. We're asking for the end of corporate rule, or we're demanding it so that we can have power to make decisions that affect us as it becomes increasingly important to be able to do so with all the other problems in the world.
And where can people find more information out about you and your activism and your work if they want to directly contact you? How do they go about doing that?
They can just go ahead and email me. My email is Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S dot Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y at gmail.com, and I can plug them into whatever they want to be plugged into, basically.
Well, that's great. Thanks for all that really good and concise information, and thanks
welcome.
For joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of Sound Waves from the Underground. We've got another really good show next week when we speak with Brinton Jones of the local group The Devil Whale. We find out about the Soundcheck series and check in with CJ from Cathedral Tattoo. Do you have a favorite kind of food or place you'd like to see covered by Yelp on our show? Send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thanks as usual for calling it. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and is produced by Gavin Sheehan, with associate producers Jeanette D. Moses, Ricky Vigil, Esther Moronio, and Jonathan Paxton. Our executive producer is Angela H. Brown. Our theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis, with our main logo and art designed by T-Done, and technical design by Kate O'Connor. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next week.